This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, will return next week. Coming up, voices from this year's Left Forum in New York. Dr. Cornel West says Americans need a revolution. Kashama Sawant says that's true, and they also need a raise. Immortal Technique speaks on hip-hop and political activism. And Harry Belafonte looks back on 70 years of struggle. But first, this month marks the 10th year of the armed occupation of Haiti by troops of MINUSTAH, the United Nations force that replaced U.S. Marine occupiers after the American-backed coup in 2004. Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, and she's an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
What's remarkable is that most people don't know that Haiti's under military occupation. And that, to me, is probably the biggest success of U.S. occupation of Haiti. So MINUSTAH's been there since 2004, and it was brought in, actually, to cover up an illegal coup d'etat against the democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in 2004, which is, if anyone doesn't know that it's 2004, Haiti's 200th anniversary, there's no surprise there, or, you know, it's not a coincidence that this happened. But MINUSTAH's there. In fact, what's important to know is that the numbers of military personnel, the strength of the force in Haiti is greater now than it was in 2004. So in 2004, where they came, they had 6,500 military personnel, about, you know, 900 local staff, 500 international civilian personnel. Today, they have almost 8,000 uniformed personnel. That includes troops and police, and 1,200 local staff and about 400 international civilian personnel. So 10 years later, when Haiti's still not at war, when supposedly Haiti has an elected president, which we'll talk about later because it's the selected president as opposed to elected president, 10 years later, MINUSTAH is not going anywhere, and there's set to be a permanent military structure in Haiti's social, cultural, and political landscape.
Well, with numbers like that pointing to a permanent military presence, how would one categorize Haiti? Certainly not as a sovereign country, one that is exercising sovereignty.
No, not at all. I call it the rules of sovereignty. There's no such thing as sovereignty in Haiti. There hasn't been for a while. I think with the democratic election of Aristide, there was the opportunity for Haiti to come back to not just a democratic society, but one that was fully sovereign. But it's right at the moment when Aristide was trying to assert Haiti's sovereignty by demanding reparations, by demanding that its people paid fair wages for all the labor that they were doing for multinational corporations. It's only at the moment that Haiti tried to assert the sovereignty that the U.S., Canada, and France, in particular, those three countries, stepped in and got rid of them. And so the late Haitian scholar Michel Rocheux said Haiti is the longest neocolonial experiment. He's right, but I actually would go further and say that Haiti is a colonial. It's a protectorate, you know, at this point, and, you know, to the extent that we have to understand it, that connection, the lack of sovereignty to the first military occupation in Haiti in 1915, which is coming up, by the way, the 100th anniversary is coming up next year. And since that time, we've just had a consistent interruption of Haitian sovereignty, primarily by the U.S., by France, and now with Canada involved.
And in deference, no doubt, to Obama, the Congressional Black Caucus doesn't say a word about Haitian independence.
And that's the most demoralizing part, and I do, and I will continue to hold the Congressional Black Caucus and Black American, what you call the misleadership class, you have to hold them accountable, because what's fascinating is that in 2004, when Aristide was taken out in the middle of the night by Marines, when George Bush sent Marines to get Aristide and put him on a plane and fly him to Africa, just think about this, right, an elected president taken out, flown to Africa and put in exile, the people who stood up against this, who spoke out against it, were Maxine Waters and some of the Congressional Black Caucus members. Now they're just completely quiet. I mean, they're quiet even at the fact that Obama sent Hillary to forcefully install Michel Martelly as president. They don't say anything. They turn a blind eye to Haiti. And so it's Obama actually made things worse for Haitians, I think, than Bush, who actually initiated this coup d'etat. And so it's a big mess, and it's going to require a major, major struggle, a major fight to get out of it, and for Haitians to actually come back and try to reclaim whatever sovereignty that they had from 1804.
And Family Lavalas, the party that put Jean-Bertrand Aristide in power with overwhelming electoral support, is still not allowed to effectively take part in Haitian elections.
Right, but the Family Lavalas is also going through its own internal shifts. And what's happened is that people are seeing the certain people who've become prominent within the party that actually going against the original mandate of the party, which is the party of the poor. And so you have these people who are reaching out now and are becoming less radical and not as involved, so much so that younger people are becoming disillusioned with the party because they see that they're not doing as much as they used to, even though, you know, I think it's a result of them being completely disenfranchised and completely manipulated from within. There's a new party called the Dessalines Coordination, which is named after Haiti's founding father, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, which is a bunch of young people who are basically challenging Minister, challenging Martelly, but also challenging the inaction of Lavalas, which was pushed out of favor because of the repression against it. So it's a volatile situation, but I also think that young people are starting to wake up. And if Family Lavalas, which has been forced to be so silent, if they won't do it, I think the young people will come up with something else.
And these undercurrents of volatility may explain why MINUSTAH is still there in force, and in fact larger force than originally.
Well, MINUSTAH is there because Martelly is just a mess. The U.S. media does not cover the explosive reports of corruption, nepotism, and just gangsterism by this government. I mean, they're just arresting political opponents left and right. There are assassinations. The police and MINUSTAH along are putting down protests against the Martelly government, you know, using tear gas and brutalizing the Haitian community. They're stealing people's land, this island, Île Lavache, where Martelly has basically went in. His land was owned by the peasants for all these years. All of a sudden, he goes in and he's like, this is public property, and he's selling it off to foreign investors. So people are protesting every day. You don't even hear that in the news, that there are daily protests against Martelly. Students are protesting, workers are protesting, and the police are answering brutally. This military that Martelly has reconvened is answering brutally, and MINUSTAH is there to support it. And so MINUSTAH is there to prop up Martelly. I mean, MINUSTAH would not be there if this was a popular coup d'etat against Aristide back in 2004. MINUSTAH was brought in because the U.S. knew that this was a popularly elected government that was pushed out by them. So they have to bring MINUSTAH in and say that it's stabilizing. What they're stabilizing is the imperialist military control and stabilizing this illegitimate and corrupt Martelly government. Until they follow the will of the people, they'll continue to say that they need MINUSTAH there because the people are against this corruption.
And MINUSTAH is led by and contains large contingents of troops from Latin America, bolstering Canada, France, and the United States.
Right. And that, to me, is the more disturbing fact. So MINUSTAH used to be led by Brazil. When MINUSTAH was taken over, it was led by Brazil. It is now led by this black woman, Sandra Honoré, from Trinidad and Tobago. So that tells you the complicity of these Caribbean and Latin American countries in the ongoing military occupation of Haiti. So it's the Sandra Honoré, who's the special representative of the Secretary General and the head of the MINUSTAH mission in Haiti, is from Trinidad. At the same time, the military commander of the MINUSTAH troops is from Brazil. And Brazil has the largest contingent of troops in Haiti under MINUSTAH. And then the country with the second largest contingent, I think it's Uruguay. So Brazil has 2,200 troops. And then Uruguay has 1,100 troops out of the almost 8,000 troops in Haiti. So you have all these Latin American countries that are supporting this military occupation, but you also have a number of other smaller countries that are participating, and I think it's, you know, for them, I think they're being paid to make it seem like it's an international coalition. So you have troops from Nigeria, from Chad, from Yemen, from Pakistan, from Rwanda. All of these people are in Haiti, you know, upholding this illegal military occupation. And that should give us pause. And it's really disturbing to think about how it is that these white nations were able to co-opt and get all these other leaders to come into Haiti. And for Brazil in particular, what disturbs me most, Brazil uses Haiti to gain an international platform. And for that, it should be held accountable and people should call it out even more.
And they have been able to co-opt Black American leadership as well.
Oh, yes, definitely, because the second in command of Minister is this Black guy named Carl Alexandre, who I think may be Haitian, but he's the deputy special representative of the Secretary General. And so now, because people were complaining that the leadership was too white, even though it was from Latin America, they switched it. They put a Black woman and a Black man at the top two positions at the mission to further legitimate, you know, or they think, this military, or to hide the white supremacist and imperialist nature of the occupation.
What do you think is the next phase of struggle in Haiti?
I hold out hope for the young people. I think what's happening, something's got to give. I think Martelly is so corrupt that even the U.S. might want to ditch him. Who knows, right? But then at the same time, what you have is this consistent protest in the past 2-3 years against both the Martelly government and the minister military occupation. Now, you have to remember that minister, the Haitians hate minister, not just because it takes away their sovereignty, but minister is known for its horrible actions in Haiti, right? So not only do you have gruesome acts of sexual abuse, murder, theft, and thuggery by these soldiers, it's minister soldiers that brought the cholera epidemic to Haiti that killed just about 9,000 Haitians and left almost 1 million sick. And 9,000 Haitians dead from cholera is 3 times the amount of people that died from 9-1-1. And so you have to put it in those terms for Americans to understand the depth of the tragedy of this military occupation, right? Because not only is it stripping Haitians of sovereignty, it's killing Haitians, it brought this dirty disease, and, you know, there's all kinds of bad behavior by the soldiers. And it reeks of this, like, really disregard for Black life, for Haitian life, and any sovereignty that this first Black nation could have.
Dr. Jemima Pierre at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Dr. Cornel West is probably Black America's best-known public intellectual. He was a featured speaker at this year's huge Left Forum gathering in New York City. The theme was Reform or Revolution, Imagining a World with Transformative Justice. Dr. West comes down on the side of revolution.
Oh, yes, we embrace the reformers, those who want to tinker, okay, if you want to be incremental, fine, but just don't stop there. We're calling for fundamental transformation of American capital society with its empire, keeping track of a vicious legacy of white supremacy, male supremacy. We have no room for anti-Jewish hatred or anti-Arab hatred or anti-Muslim hatred, and we're keeping track of the pressure. Gay brothers, lesbian sisters, and the transgender and bisexual, but we focus it also on the children, and I don't know about you, but I also focus on the new Jim Crow. The vicious prison industrial complex and its relation to the Wall Street oligarchic plutocratic complex, with vicious crimes being committed, but not one Wall Street executive going to jail. Not one. Let Jamal and the teacher get caught with a crackback off to jail. I've been teaching in prison for 37 years. I teach a course on Friday night in Rahway, and we have a wonderful time with 150 brothers, 62% of them in there for soft drugs, and lo and behold, the vicious kinds of crimes committed in high places, they're having tea at the White House. Head of J.P. Morgan Chase. What's his name? Jeremy.
John.
Diamond. Yeah, we're talking about you, Brother Diamond. I'm a Christian. I love everybody, but I believe in telling the truth. The condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. Too many folk are suffering right now. So I want to begin by invoking the great W.B. Du Bois, because it is true. Sister Amy, you're absolutely right. We've lost Maya Angelou. We've lost Vincent Harding. We've lost Amiri Baraka. We've lost Lame Breath. We've lost so many freedom fighters. And each time I come to this gathering, I think, oh, Brother Harry Magdoff, and I think of Paul Sweezy, and I think of now Bogdan's still around though, isn't he? Bogdan Dinich. He hasn't passed, has he? He's still strong. Thank God Almighty. I haven't seen him in years. We've been at it for 30 years now, Brother Stanley. 30 years. Came up with the idea it was Democratic Socialists of America. I know a lot of our revolutionary brothers and sisters kind of hard on us DSA folk. You think we all reformers? That's a lie. We got revolutionaries there. Oh, yes. Indeed, indeed. I see Brother Carl Dix there. He's a bona fide revolutionary communist. Been to jail with him many occasions. We called for us to stop mass incarceration in October, day after day after day. Say, Brother West, how come you spend so much time with a revolutionary communist? You know you a Jesus-loving free black man trying to keep track of the poor and working class. That's right. We believe in overlap. There's a revolutionary Muslim named Malcolm X. We believe in overlap. There's a revolutionary Buddhist named Bell Hooks. We believe in overlap. Visionary, prophetic, towering figure, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Legacy still alive. We believe in overlap. And of course, most of y'all are secular, agnostic, and atheistic. That's beautiful, too. That's beautiful, too. But I want to begin by invoking Du Bois, and I'm going to be very brief. He raised four questions. 89 years old. He emerges from the court. He's in shackles. Why? One, because like Malcolm and Martin, when they tried to come together in June 1964 to put the United States on trial in front of the United Nations for the violation of human rights in relation to black people, Du Bois had just taken the United States, put them on trial in the United Nations, he and Paul Rose, under FBI surveillance. And at 89 years old, he says, I have something still to say. I embark on writing three novels. And in that first novel, turn to page 275, The Ordeal of Mansart. What you got to say, Brother Du Bois, after all of your struggle trying to keep track of the dignity and decency of poor and working people, those friends for now called the wretched of the earth, what you got to say? Four questions. How does integrity face oppression? You're going to see a whole lot of wrestling with intellectual integrity in the face of oppression in the next few days. That's what this gathering's all about. That's why Brother Seth Adler and the others bring us together. And by integrity, I'm talking about willingness to think critically, vigorously, from the vantage point of poor and working people, to speak candidly, unintimidated, plain, frank speech in the face of powers that be, but also to be willing to sacrifice your popularity. Sacrifice your mainstream acceptance. Sacrifice your establishmentarian affirmation in the name of something bigger than you, truth and justice. So we're not talking about cupidity. Nobody's here because of love of money. We all need money. Wu-Tang Clan, the Creed, cash rules everything around me, but it doesn't have to rule me. Doesn't have to rule me. We attempt to be a people of integrity in a moment in which the American empire is in relative decline. It's an undeniable decay. Look at the situation of our schools. Look at the souls of our children. Look at the condition of working people. Look at the ways in which women are being dehumanized, viciously attacked. Look at the way in which oligarchs and plutocrats have colonized the courts, White House, Congress. Look at those empirical tentacles. Keep track of those precious children in Pakistan and Yemen and in Somalia with U.S. drones dropping bombs on them. 224 children in counting. Every child has the same value as a child born in Newtown, Connecticut, born in on the east side of Los Angeles,
born in Tel Aviv, born on the West Bank, born in Ethiopia, Guatemala, anywhere in the world. We attempt to be a people of integrity. Second question of the Great Divorce, what does honesty do in the face of deception? And we're dealing with organized forms of deception. It's a lie white supremacy is, male supremacy is, homophobia is, losing sight of humanity of working people and others is, organized deception intimately connected with arbitrary uses of power, especially from above. How do we become honest people? And when you talk about integrity, when you talk about honesty, it cuts across ideology. We're not talking about an ism. Talking about a certain kind of people, a certain group of people who are committed to something bigger than them, radically against the odds, precisely because what Sister Amy understands so well, the weapons of mass distraction shaped by a corporate multiplex when it comes to media. That's why we love Sister Amy so. Oh yes, she's willing to allow the voices to tell the truth from the vantage point of the wretched of the earth. Sheer honesty. Third question of Du Bois, what does decency do in the face of insult? And we can add assault. We can add attack. We can add character assassination. And yes, some of us must be willing to die. There is no movement for change, fundamental change, revolution, unless there's willingness on behalf of somebody to die. That's a fundamental fact. If all of us come together and we have no one here willing to die for the cause, in a sense it's still sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. And that's especially when it comes to black and brown and red people. Especially when it comes to vicious legacies of white supremacy. People trying to keep track of those who want to tell the truth, trying to expose the lies and try to bear witness in their own fallible way. We're not talking about self-righteousness. We're talking about a willingness to move forward in the face of the darkness, trying to keep that flickering candle alive that highlights the plight of those who are rendered invisible. That's what we're talking about. Thank God for Black Agenda Report. I saw Brother Bruce come through, Glenn Ford, so many others, Barbara, Sister Nellie, and others. We got to keep track of this vicious attempt to try to corporatize and marketize the internet. Yeah. So that we can't follow the Negro National Anthem of lifting every voice. No, they don't want the voices of those who are speaking from the vantage point of poor and working people. They want echoes of those who reflect either the mean-spirited cold-heartedness of right-wing Republican Party policies or the milquetoast, spineless neoliberal policies of the Democratic Party. Both of them just echoes of oligarchic power, echoes of plutocratic power, don't want to tell the truth about the suffering beneath. The truth is not in the middle. The truth is beneath the lies of so much of our public discussion. I'm going to sit down. But we're here because we're on fire. And we're on fire because too many of our precious fellow citizens are lukewarm. They're too callous and indifferent to the plight of our schools being privatized, to the vicious attacks on the trade union movement. They're too callous and indifferent when it comes the oligarchs and plutocrats on Wall Street and corporate elites who will be too callous and indifferent when it comes to the national security state and the surveillance expansion that Brother Edward Snowden, thank God for Brother Snowden. Thank God for Brother Snowden. Thank God for Chelsea Manning. Thank God for John Turturro. Thank God for, but they're not just whistleblowers. They're human beings who want to decide to be persons of integrity and honesty and decency. Last question, how does virtue meet brute force? Oh, here's the question. Brute force. You can't talk about change in America, reform or revolution unless you come to terms with the FBI and the CIA and the police and the army and the cannons and the cybertizing weaponry and so forth and so on. That's what we're up against. That's why people come to us and say, Oh, Brother West, y'all talk about revolution. You know America, even if it needs revolution, it only has the capacity for counter-revolution because the right-wing forces are so strong. For every socialist, you got 15 members of the Ku Klux Klan. Oh, this is America, y'all. Let's be honest about it. Our struggle is not confined to the United States. We got brothers and sisters in Latin America. We got brothers and sisters in Asia. We got brothers and sisters in Africa, in Europe, all around the world. This is a global affair. You got a global capitalist economy. You got a global working class. White supremacy, male supremacy, homophobia, anti-Jewish and anti-Arab hatred. Global phenomena. So let's not become so obsessed just with the USA that we can become so depressed when we look around and see 1,100 white supremacist militia groups, some of our names at the top. You say, oh my God, they got 1,100 white supremacist militia groups. How many left-wing ones we got? Are we working on our journal? Nothing against journals, but it's lopsided. Lopsided. That's all right. Because when you decide to be a person of integrity, honesty, decency, with a sense of virtue, you do it because it's right, it's moral, it's just, and you're willing to pay any cost. That's why we're here. That's why I'm here. I'm so blessed to be here.
Dr. Cornell West at the Left Forum. One of the stars of the conference was Kashama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party. Sawant won a seat on the Seattle City Council last year on a platform that included a $15 an hour minimum wage. The response was so overwhelming that the mayor and city council jumped on the bandwagon to pass a watered-down version of the wage hike. Sawant said the bill will still bring real benefits to working people.
Roughly $3 billion will be transferred from the hands of businesses to the bottommost workers of the city. And who are these people? They're not just fast food workers. They're custodial staff. They're childcare workers. They're people who work in nail salons, cafeteria workers at the Seattle Public School, the bus drivers of the public school district. There's a whole host of workers who make the city run, and if they didn't go to work for one day, the city would shut down, and they are paid poverty wages. I appeal to you all to think about the enormity of this victory, how historic this is. Last year, when we were calling for $15 an hour, there was a corporate media blackout. There was not a single mention of our campaign or anything. And now, hardly a day goes by without a mention of the $15 struggle in the local newspapers. And we have national and international attention. What we have done is forced business to swallow the idea of increasing the wage substantially. And I say swallow because they hate it. They hate that idea. But what's happened in Seattle is a massive shift in consciousness around wages, and that did not happen automatically. Obviously, it is latent among the working class because the conditions compel them to realize the failures of the system. But to draw it out, you need an organized movement. And that's what 15 now has done. And we have forced business into a corner where even though they hate it, they have to accept it because they don't have a choice. Just to give you a sense of how magnificent this public mandate shift has been, a recent poll found that 70% of Seattle supports a straight-up hike of wages to $15 an hour. A newspaper, a local newspaper, The Stranger, wrote this about that poll. If minimum wage opponents weren't already bricks, they're in for an awfully uncomfortable bowel movement. That is the power of mass opinion, because it's hard for businesses to go out and say, you know what, I'm against 15 because I just hate the idea of paying my workers a decent wage. And if I could tell you the stories that I have heard due to my dubious privilege of being able to talk to them as a council member, if I could tell you the things that businesses said, it would be stomach-turning. But I'll just include one quote where a restaurant owner, when he was brought to the table by the mayor to discuss $15 an hour, the first sentence he uttered at the first meeting was, "I'm furious that I have to sit here and discuss $15 an hour. You want me to pay $15 to these young kids?" And, you know, a lot of the condescension is focused on young workers. These kids, they come out of nowhere. They come in, they want a job. I have to teach them how to hold a toilet brush. I have to teach them how to cut a tomato. And you want me to pay them $15? And we were, the labor movement and myself were saying, yes. It's their right. And yet, the victory in Seattle is not complete in the sense that we haven't been able to win $15 on January 1st, 2015 for all workers who are below $15. What has happened is that the final bill that will get voted on has many corporate loopholes. Just to mention a few, big business has managed to win a 3 to 4 year phase-in period for $15 an hour. And we said, why does McDonald's or Starbucks need 3 to 4 years to bring their workers out of poverty? They don't even need a single day. There's another loophole called tip credit. I don't know how many of you know what that means. It means that tipped workers get a sub-minimum wage. There is a temporary tip credit. Restaurant owners have been successful in carving out that loophole. There is an inordinately long phase-in. That's where the 10-year period comes from. So if you're 30, you're going to be 40 years old before you actually see an end to your own poverty. We have rejected all of these loopholes, but the fact that they have gone through demonstrate to us not that it is not possible to win a complete victory, but that the quality of the victory is an outcome of the balance of forces. It is class struggle, and the only way we are going to win bigger gains for the working class is if we fight for it and we build stronger, more powerful movements than we have been able to so far. Only this morning, the Seattle Times, a bastion of progressive thinking, I'm joking, wrote that, you know, urging the city council, you know, Monday is going to be the final council vote, urging the city council to define franchisees as small businesses. It could go through if we didn't fight back. That is why we need your help. We need your continued support. Because we will not be able to pressure the city council into not passing that further loophole if they don't see that there is an entire nationwide movement that is rallying against them. Our task, our immediate tasks are very clear. At this moment, we need to push as strongly as possible to ensure the best possible deal for the working class in Seattle on Monday. But it is not just about Seattle. And this is where I am appealing to you all to recognize your responsibility jointly with us in Socialist Alternative in Seattle. We have a responsibility right now to spread the 15 Now movement everywhere in the country, because young activists everywhere are looking to Seattle and asking the question, how is this? How did this thing happen in Seattle? What can I do to make it happen here? What is that secret? What is the secret to build a movement in my own city? And that is a shared responsibility we all have resting on our shoulders on the left. This is not an exclusive responsibility or prerogative of myself or of Socialist Alternative or of 15 Now in Seattle. This is a responsibility that we all share. And the biggest mistake the left could make is failing to recognize that things are changing. We need to shake off the cobwebs of pessimism right now, because young people need us to. We will continue fighting hard in Seattle. In fact, we have been. Along with my campaign last year, Socialist Alternative also ran a campaign in Minneapolis with Ty Moore, who's also been an Occupy Homes activist, the campaign against foreclosures, who came very close to winning. And this year, we're running another candidate, Jess Speer, from Washington State, from Seattle, to challenge the Speaker of the House, the same person we ran against in 2012 and got 30% of the vote against. I've heard that he's furious that we're running against him again. We will continue to push hard for 15 in Seattle. We will continue to push hard for taxing the rich, for investments in mass transit, for rent control. But we cannot do it alone, because only doing it in Seattle is not the narrative we want for the way forward. The narrative has to be that there is nothing unique about Seattle. Absolutely nothing. This can be done everywhere, because everywhere there are people who are disenchanted with the system and are looking to get involved. The left as a whole has to do it. When we won the election last year, we heard again from the Stranger newspaper that the city council members, the sitting city council members, all Democrats, had an apoplectic reaction to the prospect of a revolutionary socialist arriving in their midst. And what we heard was that they said that it would be like a mountain lion set loose in a grocery store. I don't know where that came from. Seattle is not especially known for mountain lions and grocery stores. However, I take that as a compliment. And this is what we have to say. This is not a flash in the pan. Yes, indeed, the mountain lion has been set loose all across the nation, and you're not going to be able to put it back.
Kushama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party. The hip-hop artist and social activist Immortal Technique was on hand at the Left Forum. He riffed on the theme of the conference.
I thought the title of tonight, because I play with words, can be interpreted very many different ways. Reform or revolution? Is that a question for us, or is that a question that we pose to the people that don't want any progressive change? If you don't give us reform, pacification and placation, which a lot of times it is, you will get revolution. Therefore, to create reform, they're more than happy to see some reform come through, because what they're terrified the most of is revolution. They want reform. They're willing to tolerate some reform, but they want it in small increments because they're afraid of a challenge to the system. The other question is reform or revolution? The brother here, or the elder here, said reform, revolution. That's what we need to do. We can't just reform the aspects that revolve around us. We need to reform the idea of revolution itself. If we decide that we all of a sudden become a revolutionary-minded individual, but we don't leave behind all of the privileges that we were born with or that we've assumed in life because of wealth or racial status in America, then what really do we have as camaraderie to be with the people that are suffering the most in this system? Also, one of the things that attracted me very much to this conversation is the idea that you can believe in God and be a revolutionary as well. You don't have to choose one or the other. And I say this because I have a lot of relatives that are born again Christians, and if you argue with them about the Bible, you'll be there all day. And it's a great conversation because I know the history of Christianity as opposed to just the gospel. But I remind people, remember, it's in the writing. It's in the history of this country. You know, at the certain point, you'll find a person. Would you believe them if they said, I know everything about America, but they've never lived here, right? They've read the Constitution. They understand sort of how it works. They said, oh, yeah, I know exactly how America works, but you never voted in America. You never went to college in America. You never were arrested in this country. You never had a job. You never paid taxes. That's the issue that I confront sometimes when I speak to people who come at me from religiously fundamental views. You know everything about the book. You've read the Quran back to front and the Bible front to back. Yet you know so little about the history that created the situation for that power to arise. I think that if we apply this same mechanism and we take a look at the history of the United States, we can see that capitalism and democracy, as I said long ago, are not synonymous. And as a matter of fact, they've been on opposite sides of each other since the advent of the Republic. Just to close very quickly, people blame hip-hop and music and video games for violence in America, but I just want you to, again, read the history. This republic, since its founding, has known 20 years of peace. 20 years, ladies and gentlemen. 20 years, brothers and sisters. 20 years, mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers. 20 years, and they haven't been together, and they haven't been consistent. Don't tell me that music that the poorest people who have no control over the system make creates violence. This country was violent since they first genocided the indigenous people that lived here before people showed up. Thank you.
That was the hip-hop artist and social activist Immortal Technique. Harry Belafonte, the world-famous entertainer, has been active in movement politics for most of his 87 years. He told the Left Forum that he's most distressed about a revolution that went astray in South Africa.
I sit deeply wounded and deeply concerned that Zuma and that the ANC in South Africa has abandoned its calling. They have become the new tyranny, and this is a hard pill to swallow. How could Zuma, how could Ramaphosa, and how could all of those people who were the beneficiaries of the great struggle against apartheid, who took over the army and the nation and the political machine, they did not control the economics of the nation, but that could come. And it was something that was tooled so cleverly and with great wisdom by Madiba, by Nelson Mandela. How could all of this have gone so awry? How could Zuma and how could his government stand up and with weapons of destruction shoot down and kill 34 miners who are striking for a better wage? These were forces that started in the left. They were forces that spoke to all the great philosophers of the past history of the left, those who left guidance and mileposts and things that we could call upon. How did power so crucify these people that now they are the ones who are murdering their own? Where did we blink? What happened in that this is how we have wound up here in America? Where is, in fact, the left? Many of us are here gathered. We speak. But where is the left that we knew that had so served the labor movement? Where are the unions? Where are all the churches that had once upon a time served through instruments of liberation theology in the tradition of Dr. King? What happened? Where did they go? What have they become? And how do we now instruct our young people as they're asking for guidance? Who do we turn them to? What do we inform them about? Whom do we set up as the faces that they should see reflected in the mirrors of their lives? Where do we go for the greater truth? And currently I'm on that campaign. I'm on that march. I'm in that space. What delights me and gives me a great sense of hope is that although there's a great absence of ideological theory and development, because I think the system has been most clever in how it has erased radical dialogue, radical speech, radical thinking. They've robbed our universities of it. They have robbed the pulpits of America with it. They have robbed our political process from it. There is no vast arena of radical thought being revealed to our young people who desperately need to know what the choices are and can't get it. All the instruments that have been traditionally responsible for informing no longer inform. Many of them no longer exist. And young people in the sphere in which I reside, and many of whom are in institutions of learning, studying radical literature, radical philosophers, study on methodology and what to do and how to beat the system. Many of them say to me, gee, you know, you had it easier in your time. And in a way, they're right, because we did have signs. We did have visible daily expressions that were ordered by the state, were the plantings of the state, and our death and our mayhem was the harvest of the state. Today, you don't have signs down south that say, no Negroes, no colored, no niggers. You don't have it quite that visible. The Klan does its mischief, but fewer bodies hang on the trees in the south and in other places. Sometimes they don't have to worry too much about that, because the state and the death systems in the state fill that space adequately by putting so many together. But a lot of young people are beginning to feel a sense of the urgency of coming together, of forming a bigger alliance, looking for ways in which to be able to get to the truth more succinctly and in depth, and we're doing all we can to lead them to those places and into those paths. One of the things that we did with some of the people in the gathering and in Sankofa was to put together a delegation that went to Africa. And they spent some time in Africa looking at the plight of their counterpart. I had occasion to do that in the middle of the days of the great civil rights upheaval by taking Fannie Lou Hamer and Bob Moses and John Lewis and Julian Bond, a group of activists who needed desperately to have another frame of reference for what we were doing in our struggle here at home. And out of Greenwood, Mississippi, is where we were. We all went to West Africa and spent time with our African brothers and sisters, learned of their struggle. And I think that John Lewis and Julian Bond and those who were there will tell you that that became an epiphany for them. It was a turning point. They saw the depth and the breadth of our struggle. They saw the universal order of things. They saw that the enemy, which was common to us here, was also the same presence there, crucifying the people of the developing world, those who are in the first world to begin with. They were experiencing many things that we were experiencing here, and yet now we were just making this alliance. It has not yet completely bridged itself. There's still a lot of work to do, but many are on the path. Many are on the way. What really disturbs me, and what I hope this forum will be able to yield some vision as to what we can do about it, what bothers me is that the oppressed has become so mute. The oppressed has become so accommodating of the villainy that's being heaped upon us, and without their noise, without their rebellion, without they being in the forefront of the charge to change all this, we are at a standstill. For those who are watching us this evening, or globally or wherever, especially the artists, I'm reminded that some have stepped into this space thinking that to be part of the movement of change would be some weekend delight, only to find that when they stepped into the space, the sting is severe. And some have pulled back. I remember a story. It goes back away, but it's illustrative of the kind of intimidation that can leap on us. My best friend is Sidney Poitier, and I called him one day because I was asked by SNCC, by Jim Foreman and others, down in Greenwood, Mississippi, to come down with some money. They needed, it was right at the end of the voter registration period in the summer. All the students were on their way back to go register for the new semester. It was near the end of their tour of duty. And that was just at the time that Shirley Goodwin and Cheney had been abducted and eventually murdered. And all of the youth, it was felt by the movement that if all the young people were to leave at the time they were to leave, it would appear as if somehow they had fled in the face of that terror, and that we were therefore leaving out of terror rather than what had been contractually arranged. They'd come down for a certain period of time and then go back to start the new semester. Well, many of those students, upon debate and analysis, decided to stay. To keep them there, we needed a lot of money. And I was called to say, could I help fill that space? And I talked with Jamie, and I said, well, how much do you need? And came close to $100,000. Actually, the figure was 70. And I said, well, he said, you know, we need to put food on the table for these young people. We need to have housing. We need transportation. We need all kind of logistical infrastructure stuff. So I said, I will do what I can to raise the money. But incidentally, when I get it, where do I send it? Well, we found out that the Western Union was off the book, off the table. There was no existing mechanism to send it down because it would look, it would be an invitation to suicide if some young black worker were to walk up to the Western Union office locally and say, I'm here to pick up $70,000 from Harry Belafonte. That's the last we see of the person and the money. So we agreed that I had to deliver it personally. And in doing that, I had some thoughts on mortality that somehow just not negotiable. And that I thought it would be far more difficult for the opposition to talk about killing me if there was more than just me. So my idea was for a group of us with high public profile to take the charge to go on down to Mississippi. So I called, first one I called was Sydney. And I always call Sydney to go away on vacation. I said, you know, Sid, what you doing this weekend? And he said, I'm cool, man, I'm open. Well, what's up? I said, well, I got to make a trip and I'd like you to make it with me. You got it. Where are we going? And I said, Greenwood, Mississippi. It was a long pause, folks. And he said, what you going down to Greenwood, Mississippi for? Then I told him the story. Then there was another pause. And he said, Belafonte, let me tell you something. I'm going. I'll go. When we come back, if we come back, you're going to have to do me one favor. Never, ever call me again. Many of my colleagues with the high profile that we're talking to are sitting down right now with the phone still in their hand. They're wondering what the cost will be for stepping into this fray and trying to make a difference. And I informed them there'll be a price to pay. But then the question falls upon you. What price are you prepared to pay for freedom? What price are you prepared to pay for justice?
Harry Belafonte at the Left Forum in New York. A legendary activist was laid to rest on Saturday at Harlem's Abyssinian Baptist Church. Mumia Abu-Jamal has this report for Prison Radio.
Elombe Braff, longtime black nationalist organizer and activist, has made his transition after a long career in the black freedom movement. Elombe, 77, made his passage on May 19th, a day not without irony, for this was the birthday of one of the men he most highly regarded, Malcolm X. Braff fought numerous struggles, both cultural and political. When he was 20, he and his brother, Kwame Brathwaite, founded the African Jazz Art Society in Harlem, where they featured young artists from the community. They were jazz lovers and fans of Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Max Roach, and Abby Lincoln. He didn't just love black music and culture, he loved black people. And in 1961 launched the Black is Beautiful campaign, sponsoring shows in Harlem featuring the Grandassa models, black women adorned with full Afro hairstyles. In 1975, he launched the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, from which he worked against the racist apartheid regime in South Africa. 15 years later, he would be a top organizer for Nelson Mandela when he came to New York in 1990. Malombe Brath would work for the freedom of the Central Park Five, the five youngsters condemned in the media, imprisoned, and convicted of a grotesque rape that none of them had committed. Brath, although born in Brooklyn on September 30th, 1936, was a lifelong son of Harlem, and there he lived and worked with the ideas of his nationalist heroes, Marcus Garvey, Carlos Cooks, and Malcolm X. Brath, after a life of struggle and a long illness, returns to his ancestors.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.